This is Free Speech Radio News for July 28th. I'm Matt Martin. Coming up, a hate killing in New York focuses attention on prejudice against the transgendered. Protesters and police face off at an animal genetics conference in Minneapolis. And in Philadelphia, activists gear up for direct action at the Republican National Convention. The movement against the engineering and patenting of life continues to have a worldwide impact. Under pressure from bioengineering opponents, the health ministers of Australia and New Zealand are considering firmer guidelines for the labeling of foods containing genetically modified organisms. In France, the government recently ordered the destruction of about 1,500 acres of rapeseed plants when it was revealed that they had grown from GMO-tainted seeds. And this week in Minneapolis, a scientific conference on animal genetics became the focus of protest and civil disobedience. Hannah Lewis reports from Minneapolis on the demonstrations and the show of force they elicited from the city's police.
Some 200 people demonstrated outside the International Society for Animal Genetics conference in downtown Minneapolis. Their call was for genetic scientists to halt research until thorough studies have proven genetically modified products safe for humans and the environment. Conducted in the form of street theater, the rally mocked the scientists as well as the corporations that fund the research. They yelled out their message over the sound of helicopters above and without the aid of microphones. They painted a grim picture of the future with genetic engineering.
They can do it to animals, they can do it to us. The biotechnicians want to engineer a future where there will be perfect human beings, will not feel sickness, want, hope, faith, inspiration, anything that holds us back from keeping us away from our tasks. And they'll wipe out the biggest imperfection of all, our free will.
Protesters also had a more spiritual message. Minneapolis activist Olivia Carter.
The human species is poised to act outside of its natural limits, and that it's going too far, and it's actually arrogant for any human to attempt to control other life forms on that level. And in some ways, you could say this is an emotional argument, but those of us who feel it feel that ethical and emotional arguments should be part of the public dialogue, and that humanity does have a place in criticizing the hubris of some humans on this planet who are trying to control nature at such a total level.
To illustrate the idea of a transgenic species, protesters had a human-sized puppet of a DNA strand containing both human and animal genes lead the march into the streets toward the conference. The international team of scientists had gathered in Minneapolis to share information on the medical and agricultural applications of animal genetics. I was not able to get a response to the protest from the scientists because my phone calls were not returned before deadline.
This is what a police state looks like! This is what a police state looks like!
For the protesters, the issue of animal genetics was quickly overshadowed by another issue. The Minneapolis Police Department deployed several hundred police officers to the protest site to control the event. To prepare for this protest, the mayor's office had taken the advice from cities like Seattle, which had recently witnessed large disruptive protests. When the protesters met their first line of police in riot gear, they demanded their right to demonstrate. The police responded by telling them to stay 10 feet back.
We have the right to walk on our streets.
Protesters retreated, only to realize they were being contained on all sides of the one-block rally site by lines of riot police. For 45 tense minutes, protesters remained in the contained area. When they finally marched toward one of the police lines, it subsided and let them through. As they proceeded through the streets in a meandering path, they encountered more police lines. Now police were using their batons and pepper spray. By the end of a chase that went through a downtown park and ended up back at the rally site, 71 people had been arrested. The strong police presence at the protest was not a surprise to anyone. For a week leading up to the conference, citizens were being alerted that the Minneapolis Police Department was preparing heavily for the protest. But when the time came, at a headcount of no more than a few hundred protesters and no destruction of property, Minneapolis's protest was not on the scale of Seattle's. Some may question whether the police department overstepped its duty to protect the city. In a possibly related incident on the night of the protest, The home of some of the protesters was raided by police on a narcotics search warrant. Robert Zernick was arrested in his home on Monday and gave his account of it at a press conference after he was released on Wednesday.
I was kicked in the face several times, taken to the hospital actually, and they were executing a search for drugs, but ended up taking magazines, books, computers, pictures, files related to a nonprofit business that was being run out of the house. It's no surprise, actually, the house was raided for about 2 weeks before that. We had been organizing anti-ISAG protests.
Zernick believes he was targeted by the police because of his history as an activist and because of his involvement with the ISAG conference. The Minneapolis police tell a different account of what happened Monday night. Cindy Montgomery, public communications officer, says the raid was strictly a search for drugs. The events surrounding the protest and the police response to it are made murkier yet by police reports that glass jars containing trace amounts of cyanide were found near the protest site on the day of the protest. The FBI is investigating. As the public awaits answers to the various investigations of the week's events, public dialogue has opened up to defining what or who the police force should be protecting and how. For Free Speech Radio, I'm Hannah Lewis in Minneapolis.
With the presidential and vice presidential candidates a foregone conclusion, the real action at the Republican National Convention promises to be on the streets of Philadelphia. Thousands of people representing a broad range of interests began converging on the city on Monday in anticipation of marches, civil disobedience, and a shadow convention. Matt Rubin lives in Philadelphia and works with the R2K Network, a group which has been planning protests against the convention for nearly a year. He says the Direct Action Coalition aims to disrupt the Swiss watch-like precision of the convention's schedule. I asked him what they had in mind.
On Tuesday the 1st, a lot of the actions are centering around the criminal justice system, issues of the death penalty, basically the warehousing of 2 million people. We have record numbers of people incarcerated in the U.S., and the U.S. has the most people incarcerated of any industrial nation. Wednesday, the 2nd of August, the theme there has been coalescing gradually around the broad rubric of women. There are direct actions planned dealing with women's issues in terms of reproductive choice, women's issues in terms of agriculture, in terms of nutrition, in terms of exploitation of women and women's labor all around the world. Thursday the 3rd, right now, the plan is jail solidarity. The anticipation is that a lot of people are going to be arrested, and so that by the time Thursday the 3rd rolls around, there'd be demonstrations at the places where people are being held. And I should note, one of the places that the city has said that they're going to reopen is the infamous Holmesburg Prison. And if folks aren't familiar with that, this is a prison that's been closed for a while, but earlier in the century was the site of absolutely horrendous acts of torture, one of the most notorious being that a group of men were put in a series of cells, and on the back wall of those cells, the heating pipes ran. And in the summertime, those pipes were turned on full blast, and these men were literally cooked alive.
I know that there have already been police raids on activist centers. Maybe you could talk about how the police are responding so far and what indications you have about how they'll be dealing with demonstrations next week.
On last Friday, the 22nd, Spiral Q, which is a local puppet-making theater, which has been helping folks make puppets and other props in preparation for these protests, their offices were raided and shut down for a time by the City Department of Licensing and Inspection. The really important thing about how this happened was that it was accompanied by a police function. The person who runs Spiral Q came in that morning, and the doors to his office were unlocked and ajar, which had no one in his organization had done. And across the street, there were unidentified men taking pictures. And, you know, so this is not only a surveillance function, but it's a surveillance function that's done right out in the open as if to say, hey, look, you can see us doing this and be aware that we're watching you and that we can do this. And the other thing that is causing us some concern is the police and the authorities have shifted from an earlier strategy of trying to vilify all the protesters, which that strategy didn't work, to a strategy of saying we respect the nonviolent protesters, but you know, there might be a few bad seeds who want violence for violence's sake and who are using the nonviolent protesters as cover. We feel this is kind of a rhetorical preemptive strike and an attempt to put an alibi out there beforehand for anything that they might do during the protests.
So in Los Angeles, where there are preparations going on for the Democratic National Convention, there's been a real civil liberties battle over where and how people can protest. Talk about
the battle here too.
Talk about the constraints that are in place in Philadelphia.
Well, first of all, the city set up what you may be familiar with, what they're calling a free speech zone, which is in a small park area in the general vicinity of the convention, and all of the protest groups involved in the R2K network have boycotted that because it's the irony of having a free speech zone as if the whole city is not a free speech zone from a little something called the Constitution is just ridiculous. Aside from that free speech zone, the city intended to grant permits to no one, and the ACLU joined with a couple of the organizations in the R2K network and took them to court, and they negotiated a settlement, and that settlement has resulted in permits for a healthcare march on Saturday the 29th and the Unity 2000 march, which has a number of different organizations in it, on Sunday the 30th. These are both permitted. They're both occurring before the actual convention starts. During the convention, the first day of the convention is the Kensington Welfare Rights Union People's Economic Human Rights March, and that has not been permitted. They applied for a permit, and they were refused for that march, and no other event has been permitted that actually happens during the convention. So this is an issue, especially the KWRU march, because this is not a direct action style event, although it is fully endorsed and supported by direct action folks. And you know, it's a kind of traditional march in terms of the form of it. And you're going to have poor people there. You're going to have children, people who do not speak English as their first language, a very significant presence from the deaf community. You're going to have people who are particularly vulnerable. And, you know, it's not the kind of situation that you want. There have also been indications that the Department of Human Services in Philadelphia has been preparing up to 1,000 slots for children of people who are arrested to be taken into custody, and while they have maintained that this is temporary, poor people in Philadelphia know that the Department of Human Services is the department that takes their children away if they get out of line. So there's been a lot of constraints around that, and, you know, on the one hand, the rhetoric is they're rolling out the red carpet for us, but, you know, the reality is not that.
We're on the eve of the convention. Where would you like to see these protests end up?
We would like to see our message come across very forcefully and very vividly, which means we are, you know, going to be putting our bodies on the line. So, and we would like to see some disruption of the highly orchestrated schedules. We would like to see an affirmation and a demonstration that this movement that began in Seattle and continued in Washington is continuing and is also building and is bringing in new constituencies. And we'd also like to see that we have demonstrated by the very actions that we're doing what democracy looks like, that the people and what's going on inside the convention hall is a sham and has nothing to do with the real democratic process, and that what's going on out in the streets is really the voice of the people and the role of democracy.
Matt Rubin, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for a lot for talking to me.
Matt Rubin is with the R2K Network in Philadelphia. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan this week announced the Global Compact, a partnership between the UN and dozens of the world's largest corporations. One of the most controversial corporations participating in the compact is Royal Dutch Shell. This week, a court in Nigeria ruled that Shell must pay millions of dollars in damages for an oil spill which happened over 30 years ago. The spill turned a thick forest into an asphalt wasteland. Shell denies the spill ever occurred and intends to appeal the ruling, a process which could take another 30 years. Sam Olakoya has the story from the Niger Delta.
It's been 30 years since an oil spill from a ruptured Shell pipeline devastated Ejama Ibubu community. The people are still feeling the harsh impacts of the spill. Victor Obare is a chief in the community. He took me to what used to be a forest before the spill. A fire that resulted from the spill has reduced the place to a wasteland where nothing has grown in the last 30 years.
This is the pipeline owned by Shell. That was the pipeline was broken and eventually the spill entered this place. This place you are seeing was a very thick forest. As a matter of fact, the fire turn this place to what we are seeing now. But as a matter of fact, this has turned the events here to what we are seeing now. It's like a desert. And for the past 30 years, it has been like this.
Victor Obare says Shell adopted a rather crude method to clean the spill. Some of the spilled oil was deposited in dead pits. The oil still remains in these pits, and whenever it rains, the oil flows into the community's only source of drinking water.
The oil is still found on the surface of our water up to now. Because some years back, Shell tried their hands on cleaning. And the dug piece where this bale oil was dropped into this piece. And as a matter of fact, like this rainy season, this spill will reoccur again because this piece will overflow their banks and go back to the streams, which is our only source of drinking water.
Obare says scores of people have died in the community after drinking contaminated water. He says the court judgment against Shell did not come as a surprise because of the suffering the community has undergone in the last 30 years. But the community is now disappointed, as Shell says it will appeal against the judgment. The oil company argues that the spill might have resulted from the Nigerian Civil War and not out of its negligence. The agony of the Ejama Ebubu community reflects the plight of hundreds of other oil-producing communities in the Niger Delta. Oronto Douglas is leader of the Chikoko movement, a group resisting the activities of Western oil companies operating in the Niger Delta. He says oil companies, including Shell and American-owned companies like Chevron, adopt various strategies to ensure that they don't pay compensation when their activities damage the environment.
I could give you a lot of examples, like Chevron, the American-owned oil companies, for example, allow this crude oil to spew into the environment of the Ilaje community in Ondo State. Now, when local people raise alarm over the fact that the pollution is killing pigs, killing birds, destroying forests, and then making life unbearable for them, Chevron came out and announced that there was no spill. It needed Nigerian journalists to visit the community and the place to counter the propaganda and lies of the American oil companies.
Most times, communities give up their struggle for compensation when the oil companies refuse to accept responsibility for oil spills. But a few, like the Ejama Ebubu community, that took legal action, find that the oil companies frustrate the judicial process. Victor Obare observed that Shell held up the case with his community for 9 years with the hope of breaking their will to continue the case.
It was very, very difficult keeping two lawyers for this case for 9 years. Sometimes we pay some levies, we tax ourselves, even some very huge amounts. Put this amount together and pass it on to our lawyer to make sure that we follow this case to the last, very last.
Victor Obare fears that Shell will adopt the same delaying tactics at the Court of Appeal. Oronto Douglas, the environmental and human rights campaigner, says the adoption of poor safety standards and the determination of the oil companies not to pay compensation to their host communities is a result of their greed to maximize profit.
The cost of maintaining the environment is lower, yeah? The cost of paying compensation is almost totally non-existent compared to Europe and America. So the oil company luxuriates in this cool business atmosphere of making money to the detriment of standards. And if standards were high, the profit margin will not be that high. It is because standards are low, it is because they disregard the protection of the environment, they disregard the protection of the human beings that live in that area. It is because of this that the tension, the violence against local people and plants and animals have continued unabated.
There are indications that communities like Ejama Ebubu will continue to suffer the harsh effects of the poor safety standards of Western oil companies operating in the Niger Delta. Nigeria, a leading oil producer, makes billions of dollars yearly from oil sales. The proceeds in the last 40 years have been shared between these oil companies and successive corrupt governments in the country to the exclusion of local people. With protection from such governments, the companies are at liberty to do what they like. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Sam Olukoya in Ejama Ebubu, Nigeria.
Last Sunday, hundreds of mourners gathered in New York City to honor the life and protest the death of Amanda Milan. Milan, a 25-year-old African-American woman of transgender experience, was brutally murdered on June 20th in what witnesses say was a hate-motivated crime. As Rennie McKay reports from New York, Sunday's memorial provided a stark reminder of the struggles facing the transgender community, as well as hope for progress in the fight against hate.
I close my eyes so I can be with you. Oh, baby, be strong for me. Baby, belong to me.
Amanda Milan was born Damon Lee Dyer. For the last 10 years, she lived in New York City, for the most part as a woman. She worked in the sex industry of Midtown Manhattan, but was remembered for her talent in the fashion industry. It was early on the morning of June 20th that Milan had her throat slit by a man she apparently had never met before. Her death wasn't highly publicized in the New York media, and though witnesses say the murderer acted in hate of transgender people, the New York City police aren't classifying it as a hate crime. That failure was condemned Sunday during the gathering, which was quite unusual in many respects. The transgender community, often factionalized, mourned together. They were joined by politicians, gay men, lesbians, heterosexuals, sex workers, clergy, and some of Milan's family members. Diane Dyer McKee is Milan's aunt. She remembers Amanda as Damon, but said she and her family accepted her nephew's choices and she was moved by the show of support.
It's pretty overwhelming. I had no idea that the community was going to be out like this. I had no idea that the community was going to cry out for justice the way they did. There's so many murders that go unsolved and they never find the perpetrators or anything, but I'm really speaking on behalf of my family and myself. I'm really happy that they had a turnout the way they did, and it really does my family good to know that he was very well loved, also loved by us.
The police say the murder was a result of a dispute over turf where the alleged murderer sold illegal drugs. Witnesses say the murderer had hurled transphobic epithets at Milan and her friends before killing her. McKee said she thinks it's important that the police change their classification of the murder to a bias crime.
I think it would be important. It would be important because it'll let everybody know that they just can't take somebody's life just because of who they were or the way they chose to live their life.
Most of the people in attendance agreed with McKee, and both city and state politicians said they were working to get laws in place to include transgender people in the state and city human rights laws. Milan's murder happened just days before the state passed a hate crimes bill, but the language in the bill is vague regarding transgender people. State Senator Tom Duane, who attended the memorial, said it isn't clear yet if the bill will include gender expression.
The bill doesn't explicitly say transgender. The bill does cover hate crimes based on gender. However, I think that we'll have to wait and see when the first case is prosecuted under the state's new hate crimes law whether or not it will apply to crimes based on hatred against a transgendered person.
Activists say that right now in New York, even if the murder of a transgender person is recorded as a hate crime, it would be considered a bias crime based on sexual preference or simply gender, not gender identity expression.
Maurice Murray, shot to death October 1997. Mary S., drowned, stabbed to death 1993. Marvin Ball, shot to death September 1998.
Following the memorial service, 300 people marched to the site of Milan's murder. There, they placed candles, flowers, and incense on the sidewalk around the photographs of Milan, as the names of more than 200 transgender people, all murder victims, were read. Milan's name joined that list. Her friend Octavia St. Laurent said she had never seen a gathering like the one Sunday, but still thinks the future for transgender people will be difficult.
Thousands of others will die before there's a stop. It would be different if the government, if the police, if everybody was on our side. But you know who I fear most? The government and the police. They're the most dangerous on the street.
St. Laurent said the police have badly mistreated her because she is a transgendered woman. Sunday, directly above the grieving crowd gathered around the shrine to Amanda Milan, a tiny rainbow appeared, eliciting smiles and cheers. To many of those attending, it was further proof that the death of Milan marked a turning point in the struggle for transgender rights. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rennie McKay.
Martine Bone, murdered March 1997. Marsha P. Johnson, drowned July 1992. Bambi Lamore, murdered late 1970.
On the Caribbean island of Trinidad, citizens in the coastal town of Toco are fighting the creation of a privately owned deep water port. Although the government says the harbor would spur growth throughout the region around Toco, community members are concerned about the environmental impacts deepening the harbor will have on marine life. They also believe the plan will give too much power to the consortium which would own it, overpowering local economic control and blocking other development options. Rafael Kraft reports from Trinidad.
As they have every night for decades, the fishing boats return to the state-owned cooperative, filled with karit, grouper and kingfish. To the west, the sun glows red above Trinidad's northern coast, which stretches about 60 miles to the doors of Venezuela. It is the most renowned turtle nesting area in the Caribbean. To the east, Galera Point marks where the Atlantic Ocean meets the Caribbean Sea. I find myself in Toco, a tiny, remote village at the northeasternmost corner of the island of Trinidad.
I don't want no bungalow. I don't want no bungalow.
But in the offices of the capital, Port of Spain, a three-hour drive on a mashed and rutted road, plans have been drawn and maps have been traced to decide the fate of this piece of Eden. The Ministry of Public Works and Transport has already awarded the bid to build a deep-water port in Toco to a consortium comprising Worldwide Traders International Limited, a company registered in the Netherlands Antilles, and Leong & Partners, a local engineering firm. The project would fall under a BOOT arrangement whereby the developers would build, own, operate and transfer the facility. The government would assume full control after 15 years. Studies began 12 years ago. White collars consulted each other but failed to consult the local people. Stephen McClatchy is the representative of the SAD, the Stakeholders Against Destruction for Toco.
Over the last 4 years, what they have done silently is developed a project way out of our imagination. It has escalated into ship bunkering and a whole host of other activities. Our ecosystem is too delicate for that. We never thought that they were going to claim 17 hectares of land in the village, displacing almost 38 households. We never thought that they would want to reclaim 17 hectares of land in the sea, destroying our corals, destroying our sea moss production, destroying our lobster nests and fish nesting areas.
2,000 people live in Toco. The unemployment rate is high, 25% in a country with a national average of 11. There is no bank, no fire station, no hospital. The population lives out of the way, largely from fishing and agriculture. There is a strong wish here to access development, but not at the cost of quality of life. Julian Kenny, a retired zoology professor from the University of the West Indies.
If you build a harbour or a port of the scale that is being proposed, you're going to prevent the possibility of any other kind of development. I maintain that the thrust for the development ought to come from within the community, and it ought to be something that is compatible with the kind of community that you have there. The government could very easily arrange soft loans for entrepreneurs in the area to develop the small kind of resorts, small bed and breakfast arrangements, small mini hotels, but keeping the essential character of the Northeast.
But the word ecotourism, eco, has another meaning in the mouth of ministers. At the eve of the elections, Premier Bastio Pandé wishes to transform this remote area into what he has called a Gold Coast. Sadiq Baksh is Minister of Works and Transport of Trinidad and Tobago.
The government was driven by the urge to want to create additional economic opportunities on the entire northeast coast and the southeast coast, because in fact if you look at the demographics of Trinidad and Tobago, you will realize that more than 80% of the population live in less than one-third of the island on the western side. Basically, we have had a drift from the rural to urban areas, mainly because of the lack of economic opportunities. But our government, we are committed to economic development, but not at the expense of the environment.
Toconians are now skeptical of promises, and they should be. An environmental management authority has been created within the government, but doesn't have any authority. Natural gas has been discovered offshore, and many of the lots in the area of the proposed port are already in the hands of private firms. Trinidad and Tobago may be en route to becoming the Asian tiger of the Caribbean, but by what means and at what cost? For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Trinidad and Tobago.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters in 14 states and on four continents are striking against the Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. For more information on the strike, check out our website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. I'm Matt Martin. Tune in again next week.